listeners. This is officially the second episode of Sit, Stay, and Listen, a podcast hosted by
Zoe Lant
and Sully Lant. That's me. We're two sisters. Both love dogs. One of us knows a little bit more about dogs than the other one, but we both love dogs.
If you are a new listener, we each episode sponsor either a dog or a shelter.
We believe these shelters are doing great work in the community to find these dogs good homes and are representing these animals in a positive way and making sure they go to good homes. And if we're speaking about a specific dog, then that's one that we think is really deserving of a home and you should give a second look at if you are considering going to the shelter.
So for this episode, I would like to share the Paws and Friend Network. They were started by Tiffany Perkins. She is an amazing lady. And their Instagram account is Paws and Friend Network. Very simple, all one word. They specifically rescue senior dogs, amputees, dogs in wheelchairs, any dogs with disabilities that are most likely not going to get a home otherwise. They provide homes for these dogs. They provide care, even if it's just foster homes temporarily or hospice fosters. These dogs are loved and cared for. And even if you are not able to take in one of these dogs, because I know it can be a lot to take in a disabled dog, they have Amazon wish lists or ways for you to donate if you go visit their Instagram page. Again, that's Paws and Friends Network, all one word. It would mean so much to them and help the dogs immensely if you could assist in any way. No donation is too small. And even if it's just a toy on their wish list, that's one dog that you made that much happier because they were able to get one more toy.
And if you're looking to adopt a dog and rescue a dog to bring into your family, don't let the idea of a disability count them out immediately, because there's some dogs that have a disability that don't require that much extra work or require some kind of extra work that you wouldn't mind doing. So still consider it. They're sweet. They're often just really looking for love and would love nothing more than a home that just cares for them no matter what they look like or what kind of medical issues they have. And if you are looking to adopt a dog and don't want one with a ton of energy or a ton of issues to have to train out of them, a senior dog is always a good way to go. Today we're doing an episode about service dogs, about what they are, what it means to be a service dog, how you come across a good service dog.
We'll also touch on the difference between emotional support dogs, therapy dogs, and service dogs, and all the laws surrounding them.
So Zoe has trained her own service dog, something that not many people have done in their lives. Tell us about that process or about Millie in general.
Yeah, so when I originally got Millie, she was never meant to be a service dog. Our family dog had just passed away, and it had been about 3-ish months, and I was ready to get a new dog. We were planning on waiting till the summer so we could get a puppy and crate train them and potty train them without having to worry about going to school and work. But Millie really needed a home, so when I saw her and realized that I was a potential adopter, I talked to my parents about it and we decided to adopt her. It wasn't long after that I was diagnosed with chronic anxiety to the point of not being able to really function in public spaces alone, at least. And I started thinking about treatment methods, and my love of dogs led me to the assisted treatment of a service dog. So service dogs should never be your main treatment option unless that is suggested by your doctor. They tend to be along with treatment. But for Millie, I'm on medication, I attend therapy, but Millie assists me in public spaces where those treatment options aren't as effective. I started the journey when Millie was about a year old. She started to show potential when she started to show a work drive. When I got her, she was just kind of a crazy puppy. She was about 7 months old. But when she started to mature, I realized a lot of that energy wasn't simply puppy energy, but more the desire to have a job and work. And that job could have been pretty much anything. It could have been agility. It could have been dock diving, those two things I also do with her, but it also could have been like a detection dog or a protection dog or a police canine, anything like that. But for me, I benefited from a service animal, so that's what we started training her to do.
And what defines a service animal?
So a service animal defined by the ADA, which is the Americans with Disabilities Act, is a dog or miniature horse in very rare cases that is trained to migrate someone's disability. They must be task trained, and that is really it. Because of those restrictions, they must go through years of extensive training, and there are more restrictions and regulations, like they can't show aggression to the general public. Although, against popular belief, they aren't allowed in all public settings. The definition of a service dog boils down to a dog trained to migrate an individual's disability, and that can be, like me, a psychiatric disability, or it can be being blind, being an amputee, being in a wheelchair. Medical alert dogs are probably the most common, so epilepsy, people with diabetes, people with heart conditions, things such as that.
So the variety of tasks that a service dog can have tend to range a lot.
Yeah, they're very drastic. And I will say, a lot of times, service dog handlers, especially service dog handlers who are more able in the like movements sense, if they can be more hands-on with the training, they tend to overtrain tasks. Like for me, Millie has a million tasks and she doesn't use half of them most of the time. But for example, if you are a guide dog user, you're not going to be a hands-on part of that training process, and they tend to have less tasks, although that those few tasks are much more vital than those minor tasks that Millie has. So it definitely ranges, and the importance of each task also ranges.
You mentioned earlier that there's a difference between an ESA, an emotional support animal, and a service dog or a service miniature horse in some cases. What is that big difference between an ESA and a service animal?
Right. So both types of animals fall under assistance animals. So people use the term as service animals and assistance animals interchangeably, but they are not. Assistance animals it's a broader term. The key difference, especially between psychiatric service animals and ESAs, are ESAs require no training. Simply their presence provides comfort to people with these disabilities. A very, very small percentage of the population has even had sightings or interactions with assistance animals, yet a lot of people believe to understand the laws around them. A big thing that people believe about ESAs, or anyone can have them, you still are required to have a disability in order to have an ESA. Again, it doesn't have to be a visible disability, but that is still a requirement. ESAs, however, provide comfort by their presence, while service animals have to be task trained. And the task cannot simply be sitting by their handler. It has to be something that they do to either redirect a behavior, alert to a behavior, or medical episode, or something of that sort. ESAs, because they require no training, are not allowed in public spaces unless stated otherwise. They are not protected by the ADA. They are only protected by the Fair Housing Act. So they are allowed to live in spaces that other dogs may not be able to be, but they are a prescribed pet, while a service animal is a medical equipment.
So seeing as they're medical equipment considered by the ADA, how does someone acquire one that needs one?
So there are many different ways, and this is mainly because the ADA was trying to make them more accessible to people who need them. The most common, or well-known at least, are service dog programs. There are many, many, many service dog programs throughout America. The biggest two types of service dogs that are trained by these programs are PTSD dogs, so dogs trained for veterans with PTSD, and guide dogs. Both of those tend to be either cheaper or free. They tend to be nonprofits. Besides that, there are many psychiatric service dog programs, cardiac arrest service dog programs. They call them hearing dogs, but service dogs trained for those who are deaf or hard of hearing. That's probably the most popular way, or at least most well-known way, to go through the process of getting a service dog. And with that, all it tends to be is you put down a deposit and you spend an allotted amount of time with the dog after they are pretty much fully trained so that the program can help you adapt to using the dog. And then you take it home. And there is still some adjustment, but the majority of the training is done, and you have a service dog. The ADA does, however, allow for owner-trained service dogs. Now, owner training does not mean that the owner is the sole one involved most of the time. They usually still have to pay for a professional trainer to assist them. This tends to cut costs, but doesn't always. Sometimes it can be more expensive, especially if you adopt a dog that has to be washed. So washing means that you adopt a puppy, a prospect service dog is what they're called, and you expect that dog to grow up and be trained into a service dog, but for whatever reason, they have to be washed and cannot continue in that training. So if you have to purchase several dogs throughout this progress, you won't be saving money in the long run. But with owner training, it is easier to find a specific breed if you want a specific breed. I prefer it because I can rescue a dog and then adapt them to be a service dog, although that is a dangerous game because they aren't going to have the temperament of a purebred puppy.
So for people that choose to train their own dog, what would you recommend to look for when they're going out and either talking to a breeder about some puppies that they're going to have or talking to a rescue about what they're looking for in their dog that they want to bring home?
If you have no experience working with dogs or very little, I would always go through a breeder. And the first thing you want to ask is if any of their dogs have been adopted out as working dogs and specifically service dogs before. Sometimes even the dogs that are being bred had been service dogs and when retired went back to being breeding dogs. And that helps immensely because you know they have that work drive that's needed in any working dog, but service dogs in this case. When looking for a breed though, if you want to relate back to our last episode, that will help you with choosing a breed that is right for you, but it also is more in depth when choosing a breed for your service dog. You have to consider all factors like size. I know my dog Millie is the perfect size for a service dog because she is big enough to have a physical presence on me. So like if I need deep pressure therapy, she is large enough to give me that without being too large and hurting me, but also she can fit in smaller spaces and I'm not constantly worried that she's going to get stepped on, things like that. So finding the right size dog, the right breed of dog, so they have to have a certain temperament. If their breed has traits that are going to be problematic when training to become a service dog, that can be something that you need to look out for. So always just researching and researching and researching. And there are lots of forums that you can find with people who are willing and wanting to help. When looking for a rescue, though, a lot of rescues won't allow dogs to be adopted out to be working dogs. You just need to be careful and look for that, but also talk to the people at the rescue, see if there are traits that you can identify that would be helpful. If you know the background of a dog, that can be very helpful. Millie, for example, we didn't get at a shelter. She came directly from another family who couldn't keep her any longer. So if you can find a dog like that where you know their background pretty well, that can help also.
You mentioned earlier how Millie's the perfect size, and it kind of came to my mind that depending on the disability that they're helping with, that may vary from person to person. Would you say that that's true?
Very much so. There are some people who need a larger dog because they need to do counterbalance tasks where they provide some support for the handler. So they may lean against the handler to keep them from falling, or if they can't stand up, they may do a bracing task where they have to put some of their weight on the dog while they stand up. And in those cases, it's unethical to have a smaller dog, so they need a larger sized dog. So things like that, it will be more beneficial to have a larger dog. Same with guide dogs, tend to need to be a little bit larger just for the practicality of the length of the guide handle and the safety of the handler. Psychiatric service dog handlers tend to go much smaller, even some toy breeds at times. Pomeranians are a very popular breed. So it does definitely vary, especially on opinion, but always take in consideration what tasks you're going to need this dog to be able to perform before preference, because in the end, this dog is not a pet. It is your medical equipment.
So you mentioned cost also when you talked earlier, you mentioned that for some people, I think your example was veterans and dogs that help with getting around, so seeing eye dogs and things like that, that costs can be low to nothing depending on where you go. Is that the case for most service dogs if you're trying to get one that's fully trained? Does insurance play a role at all since it's a medical device for you?
Unfortunately, no. It does not usually cost next to nothing. Almost all guide dog programs do. Very few don't. And a lot of veteran programs, again, will either provide dogs for free or for very low costs. Sometimes insurance will help cover for it, but it is rare. The one nice thing, though, is all programs, at least all programs that I have looked into or have heard about, provide assistance with fundraising. So when you apply to get a service dog from a program, you usually get put on at least a 2-year waiting list because they only have so many dogs that they can train and they are in high demand. And so throughout those 2 years, if you apply for help fundraising, they will assist you and they will help you fundraise in certain ways. And this can be really beneficial and it can cut the cost a lot, but it isn't provided by the program directly. You can go through them, but you are still raising that money, although it might not be coming straight from your pocket.
Seeing as costs can be an issue for some people, because I don't know if these are the right numbers, but I've heard that they can be in the tens of thousands of dollars, depending on what you're looking for, how specialized your training is, and where you're going to look for it. But that could be a reason why people might want to rescue instead of, or adopt as a baby puppy and train themselves, right?
Yes, it definitely is. And there is some misconceptions about how owner training is cheaper. Depending on who you ask, it will either be much cheaper or way more expensive. I personally believe it lays right in the middle, but it is more of a chance. You are going to have to most likely find a trainer. I did 90% of the training for Millie. I still paid for a trainer at the very beginning to assist me to get ready with it, to assess Millie. And so it's not a cheap process no matter what you do. Even if you somehow manage to do the majority of the training for free, which is what I did, you still have to pay for gear. So all of vests, harnesses, if you're going to need a bracing handle, all of those kind of things, which isn't cheap either, unless you go through cheaper websites or Amazon, which is fine, but they're going to fall apart faster. You also get called out for being a fake handler if you use some of those, like if you use an Amazon vest, because anyone can access them and they tend to be the first thing people put on their dog when they just want to get them into a store. People tend to point at you and say, you're faking your disability, that dog's not really trained for this, which can be very disheartening for handlers.
Where did you get Millie's equipment? Where would you recommend are good places to start?
The best place to look is Etsy. Go on Etsy and search service dog gear, and you can get personalized gear. I personally haven't bought any new gear other than a few of her very first starting vests off of Amazon. I knew the risk I was taking, but because I didn't know what gear I preferred yet, I didn't mind paying a little bit less money and also running that risk of being called fake just to get to know what gear I preferred. All of the gear that I have is secondhand. That's also an incredibly useful thing to know if you're buying gear. I still had to pay about $85 for her current vest, but that was about half the price of what it would have cost to buy it new, which might sound absurd, but it's a personalized vest and incredible materials, so I was very happy with that price. There are a bunch of forums on Facebook and Instagram that sell or trade secondhand gear, and sometimes you can find people looking for a specific thing that you might have and trading a harness for it, and it's free for you as long as you give them whatever they're asking for and you don't mind because you don't need the leash anymore. So I would always recommend looking secondhand first, unless you have something specifically in mind, or if you're using a guide harness or a counterbalance harness, those things do depend more on your dog's size, and you might not be able to find those sizes on those secondhand sites.
You mentioned that service dogs, the only real requirement that they have under the ADA is that they be task trained and a necessity for your disability. And I'm paraphrasing. I know that's not exactly the words the ADA says, but does that factor in any way with the equipment? Do they need to have a certain type of vest that would register them or any sort of papers to register them? What types of questions are people allowed to ask? If they have papers, are they allowed to ask to see them when you go to a store or a restaurant or wherever it may be?
Yeah, so this is the biggest thing that's argued about everywhere, mainly on the internet, and mainly because people want to be able to bring their dogs places and don't want to admit to the actual laws surrounding it. So, again, like you said, I'll read under the ADA, a service dog is defined as a dog that has been individually trained to do work or perform tasks for an individual with a disability. The tasks performed by the dog must be directly related to the person's disability. So that means it can't just be a random task that you learned off of YouTube. It has to be related to the individual's disability. That is the singular requirement for a dog. They are not required to wear vests. They don't have to wear any kind of identification. There is no papers or certifications. You will find many online if you look them up, all of them asking you to pay, and all of them are scams. Establishments are allowed, however, to ask you two questions about your dog. The two questions are, one, is that a service dog? And if you answer yes, they are allowed to ask, is it task trained to migrate your disability? They're not allowed to ask about your disability. They're not allowed to ask you to show the dog performing a task. They are simply allowed to ask those two questions. And again, emotional support is not a task. So if you respond saying my dog provides emotional support, they are legally allowed to refuse you access to the establishment.
Obviously, service dogs are one of the most used pathways to get their pets into places that they shouldn't be allowed. And I'm sure that you can see why, given that you can get a vest off of Amazon and then people won't question it, or if they do, they can only ask you two questions about it anyway. So why is it super important that people respect all of the training and all the work that goes into these dogs and the tasks that they perform, and don't take what seems like an easy pathway to just get your dog more involved in your life and to get to go with you everywhere?
Yeah, so I actually wrote a research study on this about how the misconceptions surrounding ESAs and service dogs have led to discrimination in the service dog community. And it is very difficult to for those who need a service dog to function without them, especially in public. I know for me, at least, I can only go to a very few specific public locations without others or my service dog. I can't really function well in public. That's just not something that I'm able to do. And because of that, I do need Millie. And it is not a want to have her around. I wish I didn't need to have her around, but I need her. But when people come in and they bring untrained dogs who either go to the bathroom on the floor or bark at employees or other customers or are just pulling on the leash and poorly behaving, those establishments are going to be more likely to refuse access to the next person. And maybe three times it's fake service dogs, but that one time it's not. They are refusing access to a disabled individual. They are not allowing them to do what others can do because they simply can't function without that dog. Molly Burke, she's a blind YouTuber. Something she said really stood out to me. One time she was speaking out about discrimination against her use of a guide dog, and she's been a guide dog user for over 15 years now. She once said, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, but it was something like, when my dog's working, he is no longer a dog. He is an extension of my own self. He is my eyes. He's the way I navigate space. That is not simply something that's fun to have around. And I know I do enjoy having my dog with me. Because if you love dogs, you love having a dog with you. But that's not why I bring her into establishments. That's not why I take her into public. That's not why I spent so much money training her and spent so much time and hours just ruling over like all these training processes and researching and everything. I did that because I can't really function without her in certain scenarios. So by faking those service dogs or bringing ESAs into establishments, those people are, in the long run, making it so people who can't function without those dogs and really need and really benefit from what the ADA provides for them, they make it so that you can't go to those establishments. You can't do what others can do just by existing because we were born differently, because we don't have what others might. And so it does make it very difficult. And Molly Burke's just one example. She's not the outlier in this situation. But I do implore you, if you want to learn more about service dog discrimination or just the laws surrounding them, to go research her videos. Some of her videos are just her talking about her life as an influencer and all this stuff, but some of them are very educational on that matter.
We've talked a lot about Millie.
Yes.
One thing about Millie is she was a rescue that you trained, like we mentioned earlier. Another thing about her is that she's incredibly sassy. We mentioned how you kind of find a dog that could be good for a service dog. You find one that has a work drive and that is relatively intelligent and, you know, has that desire to really learn those things. Some dogs just aren't cut out for it. Millie was. But how do you combat those elements of Millie that are sassier, that she sometimes gets reactive around other dogs, or that she also is anxious? How do you combat things like that in a rescue if you're training from a rescue?
Yeah, so it is very difficult when you're training from a rescue, I will say. And certain disabilities do not allow for those attributes in certain dogs, specifically Millie's anxiety. To the point I have trained her, it is unnoticeable, specifically when she's working. Not everyone can train them to that point. And the minute times that it does reappear when we're just at home and let's say there's a thunderstorm or a fan turns on and she was startled by it or something like that, I can adapt and deal with that. Not everyone can. So that's not an option for everyone. But for Millie, at least, she is a completely different dog when she's on duty and off duty. When she's off duty, she is a pet. She is just a dog and I let her be a dog and she talks back and she sasses everyone around her and she's super sweet, but she's super crazy and always being mischievous. But the second I put her on her leash and she knows she's working and I put her harness on and we go into a store, she holds the tightest heel she can. She doesn't even pick up her tail to wag it unless I'm calling her name. And that's not because she's not happy. That's because she's so serious that she can only be focusing on what she's doing right then. And so teaching your dog the difference between off duty and on duty is a huge thing. Millie, for example, as you mentioned, can sometimes be reactive to other dogs, which was the biggest thing that I thought would make her so that she wouldn't be able to work. But every time she's seen a dog when she's in harness, she's been an angel. I never let her interact with them, but in passing, she doesn't bat an eye. And this is because even if she's on a leash, she knows she's not working if we're just going for a walk around the neighborhood or at the park where I let her decompress. And she will get more excited or a little bit more anxious or a little bit protective even, which aren't good traits for a service dog, as you said, which is again why there was a part of me that thought it wouldn't work out. But because I combated that with, when you're on duty, that's not how we behave, that's not how it works, all of these things, it adds up to being, or she adds up to being, a beautifully well-trained service dog. One of the things I think is really cute, she loves giving kisses. She's very like in your face, lovey. She's not a huge cuddler, but like when we sleep, she always curls up right next to me and stuff like that. But when she's working, if I even try to give her a kiss on the snout or hug her, she gets so embarrassed and she looks at me like, Mom, I'm working, like, stop, stop. And so it's not like I'm breaking her personality when she's working. It's like she's so determined and work-driven that that's all she wants to do. She doesn't care about the environment. She doesn't care about what I'm doing unless it's obviously something that she tasks for because that's her job. but she wants to be working. And that's the kind of dog you need to look for when you're looking for any type of working dog, because those are the dogs that obviously need a job, but also really, really want a job and succeed in their job.
I know you said that off-duty and on-duty training is really important. The thing that comes to my mind is Specca, my dog, is not a service dog. So she's not trained in even a quarter of the things that Millie has mastered whatsoever. She's never even heard of most of them. But would you say that one of the difficulties, because it has been for me training her, is when they really, really want to do something, just being like, okay, they can indulge this one time. Like if they're on duty and they're still training and you're trying to teach them on duty and off duty, and then there's like, they see their friend from the dog park, just saying like, okay, just this once you can play with them. Would that be something to look out for and something that would be an issue? Because I would imagine it would be.
Yeah, so that can be really detrimental to the training process, because there are no exceptions when your dog is fully working. When Millie's working, I don't care who walks through the door. She has to be able to stay focused on me and ignore them. And so you can't really let them indulge in those snippets of excitement when you're first training them, because if a dog truly loves their job, it is unethical to train a dog who doesn't love their job to be a service dog. You have to teach them it's okay to engage with those things, but when you're on break, or but when I release you. And so it also is important for the handler to realize that. I know originally when I first started training Millie, everything was at home or in our backyard, because if there was something exciting enough for me to not be able to keep her contained, that was going to set us back in our progress, and I was not willing to do that. Now, we would go to parks and we would go walk around the neighborhood, but she would never be working, quote unquote, on duty unless we were in a contained area where I could control all of the excitement within it, that I could be the biggest point of reward. Then you start going to those places, and I would take her to the county park where I'd walk her on the trails. And I would go to a more private part of the trail, and I would do her cues for, okay, now we're working. And we would work, and we would work for maybe starting 5 minutes, then 10, then 15, increasing that time. But then we would go to a more public part of the trails, and I would let her go swimming or chew on sticks or just have a decompression walk, sometimes even greet dogs, but just balancing that training time. A dog does not have to be on 100% of the time when you're starting initially training them. It is important for you to break them before they indulge in those things, but if you are able to show them when is on and when is off, and show them that it is okay now to play, and that although before you were working, now you can go indulge in those things. But it can't be while in the middle of your training, they start pulling, and then you go and you let them interact with whatever it is. It has to be you deliberately say, okay, you're free, break, whatever your break command is, and they are aware that you are releasing them. They are not choosing to indulge in that. So it is your command, not theirs, because it is, like I said, when Millie's working, I can't have her get excited because so-and-so walked through the door, or I'm shopping with this person and that's her favorite person ever. I need her on duty 100% of the time that I'm out in public. But then when we get home, I can break her, or even in the car, I can break her and she can go and be a crazy puppy again and do all the things that dogs love to do.
So one thing that I'm hearing a lot is this idea of when they're working, and then you can let them be a dog when they're off duty. So that's something that I hear sometimes from people in public when they see a service dog, like, oh, that dog must be miserable. Just let it be a dog. Like, let it have fun. Let it be a dog. And I think it's one thing that we've touched on, but I haven't specifically addressed, that at least all the service dogs I've met, especially Millie, because I spend more time with her than any other one, they do have a life outside of their service dog. You may not see it because you're not living with that person, or you're not with them all the time, or often the reason that you're seeing them is because they're in a situation where they are needed to perform those duties. Right. But how important is it to let them have that time, and how important is it that people understand that they are not just worked all the time constantly?
One of the biggest quoted things in the service dog community is dogs are not robots. We do not expect dogs to be on their A game 24/7. There are even days where service dog handlers will wake up and their dog's sick or just lethargic or just not wanting to work, and they have to go throughout their day without them and adapt. And all good, ethical service dog handlers, of course, there are some exceptions, but at least all the ones I've spoken to or researched or heard about are willing to do that, and they're okay with doing that, and they understand that when getting a service dog. But it is essential to give them those breaks and those opportunities. I know for Millie, I would say 80% of her day, she's off duty. When I go to college next year, her work time is going to increase. I would say it would probably be 60% of the day she's off duty, but that's still the majority of her day. She's off duty and she's playing. And then the main thing is, it is important that service dog handlers know their dogs can have breaks and need to have breaks. But it is so much more important that people who don't have service dogs understand that they are dogs before anything else. And service dog handlers recognize that. I know at the beginning of this episode, I just kept saying their medical equipment. And that is important for people to realize, because they aren't just pets, but they are still dogs. Like we mentioned in the last episode, working dogs need a job. It is more unethical to adopt a working dog and keep them inside all day and say, oh, they're just being a dog and let them run around and do whatever, than to give that dog a job and then give them time to decompress also. So these dogs are loved. A lot of people don't like it when service dog handlers say this, but they are loved more than most pets, because they are so essential to the handler, and they are given so much time to just be free and be a dog. A lot of times these handlers will spend a lot of money or a lot of time, quote unquote, repaying the dog, because they have, in almost all situations, literally saved their life. So they are willing to do anything for that dog, give them the best medical care, give them the best play times and all the best toys and the best foods and all of this stuff. So it's, these dogs do not hate what they're doing. They are not miserable. They are, one, enjoying the job they're doing, no matter how they look when they're doing it. And two, when they go home, they are living in a personal heaven. Like, they have everything they need. They are bonded with their handler just as tightly as the handler is bonded to them. And they have the best toys, the best food, and even if they don't have all that much stuff, they just get to play and or sleep or do whatever they want, because these handlers recognize that they are dogs and they are loved so, so, so much.
I would say with Millie, I think everyone that knows you and knows her, all of your friends and family, see her as a dog that is loved and has a wonderful life and home before they see her as medical equipment. And we all know, if somebody came up to me and asked me, like, oh, Zoe doesn't need that dog, she doesn't need to go to college with her, we're not gonna, you know, said something like that to me, I would say absolutely not, she needs that dog. But I don't think there's any of us that know Millie primarily as, oh, that's Zoe's service dog, she sits there the whole time while Zoe hangs out with her friends and family. It's only those situations where, at least in your case, she's actually needed. So, like, when we go over to visit with our family and it's not a stressful situation for you because you're comfortable around these people, Millie gets to be as much of a goofball as she wants.
Right. Almost all of those who are close with a service dog handler, I would agree, see that part of the dog first. It's more difficult when, say, you have a class with a service dog handler, or you're going out to dinner and there's a service dog at the table next to you. You don't know that dog. You see them laying under a chair, maybe even asleep, even though they're still working, things such as that. And it is so much easier then to say, oh, that dog has a terrible life. That dog hates their job. This person's torturing them, because you don't know them. I guarantee you, if you got to know that person and you got to know the dog, you would see their crazy side or their just being a dog side, and you would see them as that before the immaculate training they've been through and all of this that they can do for their handler. So I definitely agree that it is easier to see the dog than what they perform or what they are trained to do when you actually get to know the person and their dog, rather than just glancing at them and assuming based on appearances. All right, I think we're going to end the episode here. I can keep talking about this topic for an eternity. And
she will too. I've heard her do it.
I will. But we will continue this topic in our next episode. So if you are interested, stay tuned, and we will release that very shortly.